Welcome to the Hooked on Sport Cricket Show. This is South Australia's summer cricket wrap, where we uncover the stories, personalities and moments that define cricket across South Australia and beyond. It's time to talk cricket with Sophie Hilditch and Ben Hook.
Thanks, Wallace. Hookie, welcome back to another cricket show rendition of Hooked on Sport. How was your last fortnight of watching cricket?
Yeah, well, I tell you what, I'm in celebration mode right now, Soph, because South Australia have had a big win in the WNCL. We knocked off Victoria today. I reckon by the time people are listening to this, we'll be getting close to the start of match two against the Victorians. They are winless in the competition. There's probably one thing I want to see more than South Australia win it, and that's Victoria go winless right throughout the entire season. And they're on track right now. They're over halfway through and, they're bombed out. They're 0-7, I think. South Australia, really important win today. We will get into it. But my goodness, Soph, I feel like there is so much cricket going on right now. So, yeah, here we are. We're thinking the Ashes is a distant memory, but there is so much cricket going on. The T20 World Cup's only 4 days away. WNCL was back on today. The One Day Cup returned today. The Sheffield Shield's just around the corner, the second half of the season. Club cricket's heading towards the pointy end. I've got plenty to get off my chest. So take us through it and tell us about the guests that we've got coming up at the end of the show.
Well, I'm very excited for the guest. We've actually just finished speaking to him. It's Mark Browning, who's just done an incredible book all about the 60s Ashes, which I love listening to because, as you know, that was actually my grandfather's era. So once again, I'm learning even more about my grandpa. Like you know and a lot of people know, my grandpa was pretty modest with me. We spoke mainly about golf and he barely ever spoke about his cricketing career. So it was lovely to speak to Mark, and that will be at the end of the show. Like you said, so much going on in the world of cricket at the moment. And I want to get your opinion on this. Australia, 3-0 loss against the Pakistan in the T20. Well, I want to say warm-up. Mm. What are your views on that? It was absolutely moral-sapping, I want to say. It was a capitulation. It's one of the most dire T20 results we've ever had in Australian cricket.
The second match was a record-breaking loss. And then we beat that in the third match with another record-breaking loss. So, look, under normal circumstances, Soph, I would probably say that Australia's campaign is wobbling. Pat Cummins has pulled out. Josh Hazlewood is going to start late. Adam Zampa's under a bit of an injury cloud. And we've gone into this series getting some absolute whoopings. But Australia does have a remarkable tendency to start these types of tournaments very slow and work into them extraordinarily quickly. So I'm going to take them on trust. I'm not going to throw the baby out with the bathwater here. Their first two games are against Ireland and Zimbabwe, so I expect them to win those pretty comfortably. They'll then play Sri Lanka and Oman. So even if they lose to Sri Lanka at home, which I don't think... Sri Lanka will be very competitive at home, but they're going to beat Oman and they're going to go through in second place and they're going to make the last eight of the knockout stage. And that's when it gets serious. And, you know, if you can win three straight from there, well, it obviously gets more challenging because you're going to be fronting up against England, who look extraordinarily good, and India are just all powerful in particular. They're going to be playing all of their matches at home. So, yeah, it looks a bit disastrous for Australia, but I've seen them in these sorts of positions before and find their way through. So let's not give up on them just yet. But I tell you what, Soph, if they blow a game like against Ireland or something like that first up, then I think it becomes a very different narrative. And I will be outraged.
Well, I'm interested at that point of view because they really struggled against the Pakistani spinners and they're about to go to Sri Lanka, which is very spinner friendly. So I'm curious as to your thoughts on that.
It's a good point. I think the Sri Lankan wickets will play a little bit better than the Pakistan wickets. The other thing that happened as well, they lost the toss every time and had to bat second on wickets mm-hmm. that I think were always going to deteriorate the longer that match went. That certainly played into the spinners' hands. Australia also really, they didn't treat this like warm-up matches. They really did move their side around. So Matt Short played every game and isn't going to be in the World Cup squad. Mm. We saw a lot of chopping and changing. It was very, very experimental. Give a few guys a go. Keep some guys fresh. Obviously, they want to have them ready to go for the first game against Ireland. Well, we're going to be one or two short. Cummins obviously out, and Hazelwood won't play that one either. So, yeah, look, I do feel like there are some justifications for having a few alarm bells around, but right now I will take the Australian team on trust that they've been here before, done it, and always come out very well out the other side. And the 2023 50-over World Cup is a classic example of that, where they blew their first two games and then went on a remarkable 9-run winning stretch, which culminated in that remarkable 100-and-something from Travis Head to beat India at India in the final. So, I'm still very confident that these guys know what they're doing, and I'm not too bothered about the three losses to Pakistan.
Rate your positivity. Very unusual coming from you, Hooky. So good on you.
I tell you what I am bothered about. Cameron Green suggesting that Usman Tariq is a thrower was a pretty poor look from an Australian cricketer. He is an unusual bowler, Usman Tariq. He's got a bizarre run-up that comes in almost from the side of the pitch. He almost stands still at the point of delivery. His arm is slightly bent as it comes through. It is unusual, but I think the way that we do have a bit of a habit in Australia of defaulting to this bloke must be a cheat because he does something a bit unusual is really unprofessional from Cameron Green. It sounds like he's apologised to him, and so he should. It's such a nasty accusation calling someone a chucker. It has been that right throughout cricket. And to infer that on the field in the manner that was done by Cameron Green, I thought was pretty poor form. So I hope we see the last of that. And, it's worth making the point. Usman Tariq has been cleared a couple of times by independent testers that even though he's unusual, he's not illegal. And if you're unusual but not illegal, you're a really handy asset, in particular in this form of the game where it might take you three or four balls to understand how to actually experience that ball coming towards you in that manner. So good luck to Usman. And I just hope that we don't get that in our heads that because Cameron Green gave that chucking symbol in game two, that the rest of Australia is going to climb on board, because I think that would be unreasonable.
Just as I was giving you credit for keeping positivity, you've just gone and you've gone on a huge rant. Look, I actually wholeheartedly agree with the rant. I thought it was a bit of an outrageous. And I agree with you. I hope it doesn't cotton on with the Australian public. But I love it. I'm starting to go on this big spiel about great. We can move on to the next topic of conversation. But not sirens.
Jumped in.
Stop. I forgot about it. I did have something negative to say about it. I did have a little gripe. So, no, respect, Hooky. I'm glad you jumped in there.
But look, you know me, Soph, I can find negativity in anything.
I've seen it. You can flush a shot and still say something went wrong. Look, yeah. Talking about Pakistan, let's go straight to the recent controversy that's only really come out in the last, 48 hours, 24 hours at the time of this recording. So it'll be a little bit older by the time this comes out. But the Pakistani government has granted approval for the Pakistan cricket teams to participate in the T20 World Cup, which starts on the 7th of Feb. But they're not to take the field in their match scheduled for the 15th of Feb against India. That means they are going to forfeit the 2 points. It's interesting, isn't it? It feels like politics has really taken over, and it's a shame to not see these rival countries playing against each other. I think it'll be a big loss of money to the ICC as well. It's a popular event. It's a popular rivalry. What's your initial take on the whole situation?
Well, I think you have grasp the concept of what's going on here absolutely perfectly, Soph. This is not a Pakistan Cricket Board decision per se. It's a Pakistani government decision. And the intertwining between the two organisations is patent. So Mohsen Naqvi is the chief of the Pakistan Cricket Board. He's also the Minister for the Interior of the Pakistan government. So these two organisations are inextricably entwined together. It's very, very similar in Bangladesh. It's very, very similar in India. And so, unfortunately, we have this situation where the good of cricket that you would think that cricket boards, national cricket boards would have, the good of the game globally, to be able to foster these relationships. Yes, you might be a rival politically and geographically or geopolitically, but you can still play a game of cricket against each other. And that's what the ICC and the international global cricket community has relied upon for funding for the last 30 years. The fact that India and Pakistan are always scheduled to play against each other in the group stage of a World Cup, because we know that that pays all of the bills. So Pakistan have threatened to pull out of this game. And I'm not sure where we're at, and I'm not sure where it's going to be by the time people listen to this. And I imagine it's probably moved, and it may be it's moved that Pakistan are kicked out of the World Cup altogether. I mean, that would be drastic, but India hold all the cards here, and that's every possibility that that's the Indian reaction, and therefore by extension what the ICC reaction will be. In the end, if this game doesn't go ahead, it is a disaster for the competition, because it costs the same amount of money to put on India versus Pakistan as it does Ireland versus Oman. And I can guarantee you the Ireland versus Oman clash is not going to bring in the same television eyeballs that Geo, the television broadcaster, is banking on and has paid out all of this money for. So someone's going to be asking for an enormous check back if this game doesn't go ahead. The ICC, quite rightly, will be asking Pakistan for the lion's share of it. And the extension of that is going to be that nations like Ireland and Oman that rely on the drip feed of funding that they get from participating in these tournaments are not going to get anything like what they would have been counting on and relying on to try and continue to nurture the game. So it is unfortunate that all of this political posturing that goes on between the Pakistani government, the Indian government, that uses sport and such an important sport in the region as a bit of a pawn for its own, to wield its own political power. And that's what I feel like we're seeing here, Soph. And so I don't hold out much hope for it, because both of these governments are too proud and too invested in their retention of power and looking like they're wielding the stick against the great rival for their own good and for the good of the sport itself. So that's the situation that we find themselves in. It's impossibly sad, and I don't know that we're going to see a way out of it. And if we cannot get these two nations, they haven't played a bilateral series now, I think, in 19 years. Mm-hmm. And if we don't see these two organisations work it out and be prepared to play against each other in these multilateral series like World Cups, then I fear for the economy of the game, because that drives a lot of it, the clashes between India and Pakistan.
Yeah, they haven't played bilateral cricket since 2012, I want to say.
2012, although I had 2007 in my head, yeah.
Yeah, so I want to say it's a big shame, and it is a shame in politics. I think sport, for me, is something that can really bring people together, whether or not that's you're supporting a team or going against. Really sad that it's getting used for anything different. I think politics should be put aside when it comes to sport, particularly between countries.
Imagine if Collingwood and Essendon decided they disliked each other so much that they weren't going to play each other in the AFL anymore, that Anzac Day would be a footy-free zone. And you think what goes into Anzac Day and all of the eyeballs and all of the tickets bought and all of the investment in pay TV. Imagine if someone just said, no, that game's not going ahead anymore. And it just so happened that Eddie Maguire was the head of the AFL as well. What would the penalty to Essendon be, you think? So, and this is where Pakistan finds themselves right now. And it's an unenviable position, but it seems like they are just so determined to thumb their nose at India and the ICC that there's probably no backing down from the position they're in, and everyone's going to suffer.
Let's move to the BBL. The BBL finals were on since our last podcast on cricket. The Scorchers beat the Sixers in the BBL final by 6 wickets with 15 balls to spare. It was an amazing final. I did enjoy watching it. It was over a bit too quick and it was kind of a bit one-sided. But look, I want to seek your opinion about the private ownership which is stalking the BBL at the moment.
No, it's a really good question, Soph. And you've identified the fact that the Scorchers played the Sixers, and who knows, they might be called the Chargers and the Sunrisers by this time next year if Cricket Australia does give the green light to start off-selling the franchises. It seems for everything that the secondary franchises in the Melbourne and the Sydney market, so that's the Sydney Thunder and the Melbourne Renegades, look like potentially up for 100% sale. And then every other franchise could be sold by at least by 49%, potentially more. Who really knows? I mean, there's going to be an extraordinary amount of money on offer for these franchises. They're valued, I think, at somewhere between $400 and $800 million each. So you think about the Adelaide Strikers and the South Australian Cricket Association, if they could bring $300-400 million into the door to off-sell 49% of their franchise, you can understand why they would do that, because then that drip feeds a whole host of money back through into the grassroots of the game. It sets them up for generations and generations. Makes sense. It also makes sense from the perspective that we're seeing this all throughout global cricket, the South African League, the 100, the International T20 League, the European League is all going down this road of private ownership. And so, yes, I can understand that. Am I comfortable, though, with private owners being the lion's shareholders of the Australian domestic summer? That's something that is a very, very difficult question to answer, and something that I do feel like I'm going to be uncomfortable with. Yes, I've heard that the BBL has been around for 15 years and these franchises are strong and the brands are something that will endure. But do you really think someone who is coming from the IPL and perhaps is involved in the Mumbai Indians is going to invest in the Adelaide Strikers or the Perth Scorchers or whoever it is and not want them to be branded MI? Like they've done in the South African League, like they've done in the International League. That's how they roll, you know. They want to globalise the Mumbai Indians brand. And the idea that they're going to invest in the BBL and not want to do that is just, I think it's folly to think that that's not going to be the case. So, yes, the money will be extraordinarily good and I trust the state associations to use that money wisely, but are we comfortable with the lack of control of our Australian domestic summer that will come with it? Are we concerned that we're going to have to potentially move Test series right out of that Christmas window because these private owners are going to be demanding that the best Australian players are playing in the BBL and not being conflicted with Test matches and Australian white ball games at the same time? All of those things are really awkward questions to ask. I don't think we should shy away from it, but I do think we need to tread very, very carefully here because you're only going to get to sell these once. And once they're sold and once these enormous private investors have their fingerprints on it, it's very difficult to sandpaper them off again, Soph.
I think that was an excellent summary, Hookie. I share your nerves towards going towards private ownership. I think it, with money comes a bit of suggestion that there could be some corruption involved. There's always issues with that. I also think it just moves us further and further away from our grassroots, but I also see the positives with going to private ownership and what that could look like for the league. So I think you've done an excellent summary there. Let's go on.
Just before you go, the other thing that might be positive about it as well, Soph, is that the ground announcer for the Adelaide Strikers may get a bit of a pay rise if there is private ownership. So let's not stray too far away from that possibility.
Yeah, 100%. Get rid of private ownership. Don't want it anywhere there. Can't be giving that guy any more money. He doesn't need anything else going towards his head. That's for sure.
I think they're paying me the same rate they were paying me at about 2017. I need a private owner.
Well, look, I was going to say, you started talking about it at the top of the show, but let's get into the Women's National Cricket League. SA are obviously hosting Victoria at the moment. They played tonight, which is Tuesday at the time of West recording. Their next game will be on Thursday. What is it looking like for the SA girls? They're starting to look more and more like they're going to gain a finals position.
Still hard to believe that they blew both games against Western Australia. Yep. That was an absolute mystery to me. And I just wonder if they didn't quite take that on with the right mindset, because everything I've seen of what they've done in Queensland and then today against Victoria, they are really mentally switched on, and that is so important. There's a couple of things I'll say about South Australia. First of all, the women's team, their top order is a bit of a worry. Bridget Patterson, who has been extraordinarily good for a long time, just looks to be a little bit out of form to me and has been for some time. Emma Dubrow, her opening batting partner, is a very, very good player. Her best is excellent, but she has been a bit inconsistent. Courtney Webb, a bit like Bridget Patterson, is a great player in this competition, but just isn't at the peak of her powers at the moment. Maddie Penner is in one of the all-time great funks. She's made a duck in four of her last five innings, and hopefully she can come out the other side of that at some point. That happens to every player at some time, but she is deep in a real funk at the moment. I saw her after the game, and you can see that she is quite tormented by the fact that she just cannot get a ball off the square at the moment. But look, they won. Talia McGrath got run. She scored 58. She's another one who hasn't been in great form for a period of time, so that was important. Holly Armitage came in the middle order and swung hard and just threw the Victorian fielding off. They made some mistakes, the Victorians in the field. And then, of course, Gemma Barsby, who is just such a clever little worker of the ball, 33 runs at more than a run a ball. Just she got to within a run and then unfortunately got dismissed. Would have been great to see her hit the winning run. So they're a bit of a cardiac cricket team at the moment, Soph. I feel like they should have won that game comfortably. They did a really good job. They were 3 for 175, Victoria. Annabel Sutherland was in and on 70-odd, and they made a couple of breakthroughs, got Sutherland out, restricted them to 226. It should have been a pretty straightforward chase. They did it tough. The cardiac cricket team, I'm calling them at the moment, but they've won three straight now. They're up to fourth, and they've got games in hand against the teams that are above them on the ladder. So I expect, and look, unless Annabel Sutherland, and she has the capacity to do it on her own, unless she goes out and blazes 150 in the game on Thursday, I expect South Australia is good enough. A more consistent team, if you like. There's some young kids in that Victorian lineup. I expect them to survive that game, and they'll probably be up in third and really chasing New South Wales and Queensland for a top two spot heading into the last, what, four games they'll have before we all wrap it up. What's it? It's a 12-game season, and they will have played eight by the end of the day Thursday with two away games against New South Wales and two home games against New South Wales, two away games. I reckon it's against the ACT still to come.
Yeah, it's great. I always get a little bit worried when you're playing the team at the bottom of the ladder and you're expected to win. It always makes it a bit scared. And sometimes there's that ability to drop to their level because, you know, your expectations are just, I should win. So I think I was pretty proud of the win that we had today. And I love it. You put yourself out there. You've predicted that we'll get the win on Thursday. And this podcast might prove you wrong, but hopefully it proves you right.
Rhys McKenna is the captain of the Victorian team. She's very, very inexperienced compared to the fact that Annabel Sutherland and Sophie Molyneux, the new Australian captain, are both in that Victorian team. But gee, I thought she captained very well. She set excellent fields. I thought she protected the boundaries really well, and that can be tough to do sometimes at Karen Rolton Oval. And quite frankly, there were four or five balls that should have been very elementary pieces of fielding by the Victorians that all went through hands and to the boundary for four, and that was probably the difference in the game. But Rhys McKenna, I thought, had managed her bowlers and her fielders really well to potentially win that game. It was only some fielding mistakes that allowed South Australia through, and so South Australia a little bit lucky, but at the same time it was good to see some big names just break through. Holly Armitage getting some runs, in particular Talia McGrath, 3 wickets and 58 runs, the player of the match, she was named straight afterwards. So gee, that was important for her and important for South Australia as well.
Let's go closer to home. How about you run me through the club, the Premier Cricket, the first grade Division 1 results?
Yeah, for sure. So West Torrens played Tea Tree Gully. Dan Mousley made his return to the West Torrens team. He's an English international recruit. He blazed 100, led West Torrens to 9 for 289. Tea Tree Gully 1 for 3 in reply. So West Torrens, who are in the bottom half at the moment, that was a really important performance for them. You'd expect them to go on and win. Sturtra in second place, absolutely skittled by Port Adelaide, who are in third at the moment. Bolt Sturt out for 74. They're 6 for about 190 going into day two. Valenti and Grieber for Port Adelaide took 5 wickets each. Port are essentially in second spot now, so that's a great performance from them. Won the flag 2 years ago. Not quite so good last year, but expect to see them back up the pointy end. Woodville, who were the bottom team, they only lost 5 wickets for the day, scored 300 runs against East Torrens. It was an interesting day. 5 for 300. The highest score was Aidan Cale with 63. So I think there was 5 guys with 50 and no one scored more than 63. So the Peckers are a game clear on the bottom. They have a score to defend at least, but they'll need those 10 wickets against East Torrens this weekend. And then really even game. Adelaide in fourth, we're all at 253 against Kensington, who are no wicket for 12. The Browns are top. Maybe the Browns a slight edge there. Noah McFadgen scored a century for Adelaide. He was the Bradman medalist, one of four last year, so for four-way tie. So that wraps us up in Division 1. Do you have a quick look at Division 2?
Yep, go for it.
Glenelg, 6 for 361. They absolutely bullied the South Australian under 19 team, who were 2 for 13 at the end of the day on day one. Isaac Higgins scored a century. Ben Bullimore scored a century. Saw Isaac Higgins' dad, Ben, very good cricketer for South Australia, played league footy for West Torrens as well. So both of those guys got centuries. Seahorses are almost certainly returning to Division 1. A prospect of 5 for 26, chasing Northern District's 201. The Pirates were bowled out for 111 in a one-dayer against Glenelg last week, so they are having a hapless run with the bat. And Southern District have uni done after day one. It's their third straight win, Southern District, a team that I wasn't necessarily expecting to threaten a Division One spot this year, but they are travelling very, very well. Highly commended. Your brother's team have let me down a bit, to be honest, this year, because I expected them to be one of the teams that would threaten, and they're down in fourth now and really struggling. So highly commended, Southern District, the Stingrays. Well done to have a win after day one. Exceptional performance. And they're very, very handy points. They're in second now, Southern District. And, yeah, big chance to be up in Division One next year.
Well, how about you take us over to the Women's League?
Glenelg defeated Kensington, and they hold top spot. My word, it's a wobbly run chase. So if they were 8 for 125, chasing 166, Ellie Phillips joined Kayla McGrath. So Kayla McGrath, captain of Glenelg and the sister of Talia McGrath. And, yeah, they put on 44 unbeaten partnership for the 9th wicket to get them home. So Glenelg still top. Sturt and Adelaide are in that fight for third, and Sturt made a real dent in that with a big win over the Buffaloes last weekend. Sturt got about 190. Adelaide were bowled out for 91. Talia Keylock, who's been a good player for Sturt for a while, took 5 for 10 for the Blues. So, yeah, it's looking for everything like it'll be a Glenelg and Kensington grand final. Sturt can possibly upset that apple cart, but I'd suggest West Torrens definitely gone at Adelaide. Yeah, very, very unlikely, I would think, on the back end of that performance, that they can threaten the two sides even higher than the Blues.
Brilliant job, Hookie. Well, let's hit to my favourite part of the cricket show. Hit me with Hookie's local legend.
Hookie's local legend this week, Soph, is Ben Hook. I'm not making this up.
Okay.
I'm very excited to tell you it's Ben Hook, the local legend. Unfortunately, it's not me.
Oh, okay.
Can you believe it, Sophie? There is a second Ben Hook. He's currently playing cricket in the Northern Areas League for Spalding Boobarawi. Plays in the Northern Areas A-grade competition. He's the leading run scorer in the competition at the moment. He's got 476 runs and an average of 68. Now, I catch up with this guy once a year. Day three of the test, he comes down, lives at Crystal Brook, I reckon. He comes down to the test match, goes to the lunch. I obviously MC that lunch, and we catch up every year. We get a photo done together. We were both in pink shirts as well on day three of the test this year. So Ben Hook from Crystal Brook, playing for Spalding Boobarawi, leading run scorer in the Northern Areas competition. He is Hookie's local legend this week.
Well, I'm glad to hear it, because part of me just thought maybe you just started Googling yourself and you just thought, well, better add this Ben Hook, that would be great. So I'm glad to hear you actually know this guy and you actually spend day three of the test match every year with him. But no, you almost got me there. Well, you did get me there. I thought you just put yourself down. I thought, I didn't know you returned to cricket.
I actually thought when I said my name that you would just shrug your shoulders and go, yes, I've been expecting this for a while. It's hard to believe that it hasn't come until, you know, about our 15th show. So, there you are. Ben Hook, the local legend for this week.
No, I absolutely love it. I should be expecting you to put yourself down there soon. I'm sure you'll get another team hole in one in our golf show, and you'll let me know that he's Ben's best for the week. Look, let's go to Hooked on Sports medal. What is the tally? What is the ladder looking like?
Yeah, well, the women are starting to close in, Soph. We've known that there'd been a lot of men's one-day competition, the Sheffield Shield. So we're right into the peak of WNCL season now. So 3 WNCL games to add to the total. I'll give you the votes from today's game against Victoria. I gave 3 votes to Talia McGrath, 3 wickets and 58 runs. 2 votes to Gemma Barsby, led the team very, very well. Heard an interview with her afterwards. She was extraordinarily pleased with the way her team bowled. Well, she is bowling as well as she has in her career. Took 3 for 24. The only mistake she made was she didn't bowl herself enough. She's just bowling so beautifully at the moment. Also, with those 33 runs late, she picks up 2 votes. And I gave 1 to Megan Shute, who wound back the clock She doesn't play a lot of one-day cricket anymore. She's a bit more T20 focused, but she's turned out for South Australia, bowled superbly to take 2 for 39, including the wicket of Nicole Fulton in the opening over, which really set the scene for South Australia. So she picks up the one vote. If we head over to the matches against Queensland, the first game against Queensland, Amanda Jade Wellington took 5 wickets. She gets the 3 votes. Emma Dubrow scored 71, opening the batting. She gets the 2. And Gemma Barsby in the middle order made 42 not out and bowled pretty well as well. So she picked up the one vote there as South Australia beat Queensland by 4 wickets. And then in the second game, South Australia won an absolute cliffhanger, Soph, by 1 wicket. They put on a 35-run partnership for the final wicket between Eleanor LaRosa and Darcy Brown. It looked for everything like this game was absolutely lost. And, the 10th wicket partnership between LaRosa and Brown got us over the line. So on that basis, I gave Darcy Brown the 3 votes for her 5 wickets and those late runs. Eleanor LaRosa, she guided us home. Her figures don't look anything too superb, but just to handle that situation for a young kid was incredibly impressive. So she gets the 2 votes in that game. Gemma Barsby picked up 3 for, so she gets votes in 3 games in a row now. She gets the 1 vote in that second game against Queensland. Brings me to the leaderboard, mate. Nathan McSweeney is still leading on 9 votes by 1 from Mackenzie Harvey. Jake Lehman is 1 further back on 7. Nathan McAndrew and Liam Scott are on 6. And then it starts to really bunch up. On 5 votes, Wes Agar, Brendan Doggett, Jordan Buckingham, AJ Wellington, and Gemma Barsby. And that probably means that Wellington and Barsby are pretty much in the lead at the moment because they'll get bonus votes for the fact that they'll end up playing less games. I think we've explained that in this podcast before. Henry Hunt, Courtney Webb, Ellie Johnson, Darcy Brown, Tali McGrath, all on 3 votes. Connor McInerney, Lloyd Pope, Maddie Penner, Harry Manenti, Ben Manenti. Both Harry Manenti and Ben Manenti over in Italy, at the World Cup, playing for Italy at the moment. That's a cool little side story. Yeah. They're both on 2 votes alongside Emma Dubrow and Eleanor LaRosa, and 1 vote to Courtney Neal, Harry Nilsson, Megan Shute. That is our leaderboard in the Hooked On Sport Brownlow Medal, Soph.
Loving it. Like you said, starting to look a bit tighter with those women playing a few more games and starting to play a bit of catch up. Look, loved it. Love this podcast. Let's, like I said at the top of the show, let's go to our interview with Mark Browning, where he talks about his book, The Ashes, a front row seat to an iconic era of cricket in the 60s.
Well, Sophie, our guest today takes us straight into one of cricket's most misunderstood eras. Mark Browning is the author of The Ashes, a front row seat to an iconic era of cricket in the 60s. And Sophie, this features your late great-grandfather, Bob Simpson. We're going to have a vivid look at the rivalry, the characters and the moments that shaped the modern game. And we're delighted to have him joining the podcast. Mark Browning, welcome to Hooked on Sport.
Thank you very much, Ben. Pleasure to be here.
Just touch on this current series. I mean, it feels like an eternity ago. It was only, 3.5 weeks that it finished. How does that stack up with all of the other Ashes series that you've watched and studied? I felt like this one just lacked a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, a few people have spoken to me about how disappointed they were with it as a contest and, you know, some of the poor quality cricket. But I must admit, I went to 3 of the tests and obviously Melbourne was, not just because Australia lost, was very disappointing, but Adelaide and Sydney I went to and I had a ball. And I people are asking, you know, saying they want to see competitive Ashes. If we win 5-0, I don't know. I don't know why, but I dance around and with in delight. So it's, I thought it was great. I thought it was, I'm missing it, and it was a really good, enjoyable Ashes series. And to win 4-1 is very satisfying.
Mark, I've studied the early days of Test cricket, the quaint story of how the Ashes became the Ashes. I've read about body line. I've read about World Series cricket. The English incompetence of the 1990s is sort of my sweet spot. But it's almost unbeknownst to me, the story of the ambivalence towards Ashes and Ashes cricket in the early to mid-60s. Just take us through what your research and, I guess, your lived experience uncovered.
Well, I mean, there were such great crowds in this summer and in the recent times. And, I mean, to get a ticket in England for any Ashes test now costs a mint and are very hard to come by. That wasn't the case in the 1960s. So there were plenty of results in the 50s, but there was a bit of ill feeling developed between the teams. And by the 1960s, it was kind of a case where you held the Ashes, and Australia held the Ashes right through that decade, and it was like a 1-0 lead in soccer. Once you got in front, you got everyone behind the ball and you held onto your lead. So there were great players. There was some great cricket against other countries. The weather wasn't great, but the Ashes was just fizzling out a bit. And culturally, it was a time of great change. So I'm a bit of a fan of the Beatles as well. And of course, they emerged in the 60s and they changed popular culture as well as creating all that fantastic music. So, yeah, 60s Ashes cricket, it was a little on the nose. And until Ian Chappell's side sort of revived it, and Barry Nichols has written a great book on that about the 72 Ashes series in England, there was lots of talk about actually ditching the whole concept and it going back to just a normal 5-match series, you know, made the best team win.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is incredible. I mean, I think about it now, it was only 15 years ago. People were talking about going back to only one showdown between Port Adelaide and the Crows. Imagine the concept of only wanting to have that incredible rivalry and that incredible contest once. It sort of beggars belief that someone would think that the Ashes didn't belong. It's just incredible. That was sort of the attitude of the time. You talked about how society was changing. The Beatles, the swinging 60s, we all know the stories and you lived through it, Mark. But the fact that cricket was being led at the time by characters like Bob Simpson, who were very, very conservative, Brian Booth, devout Christian, also extremely conservative. Was there a real clash of cultures there between the way society had moved and the way cricket was, I guess, approached by the people who were most seriously in charge at the time?
There was an element of that, but I don't want to condemn these guys because they were great players and, you know, fine men. And I've spoken to them. And, you know, it's really sad that we've lost some of them since I started writing the book. But there also was the case that the batting was probably better than the bowling in that era. It was a transitional period for Australian cricket. So through that decade, Graham McKenzie was really the only bowler you'd say who was test quality. And the same with England. They lost Freddie Truman and Brian Statham, and it wasn't until later in the decade that John Snow came along and they were a really good bowling side as well. So that was a factor. There were a lot more runs and it was easy for guys who had very good techniques to hold out against the opposition. Plus the intensity of the rivalry, plus the weather. So in 1964, at the test at Lord's, the first 2 days were washed out. And I spoke to Tom Vivas about this. The weather forecast was okay for day two, but they got there and the ground was still wet and it didn't dry out all day. Yeah. It was overcast. There might have been a little bit of drizzle. No play on day two either. So those factors meant, and some in Brisbane had, and when Doug Walters got his debut test 100 in 1965, that was ruined by rain. There was a lot of rain about for some reason as well. Plus, there was just a whole negative attitude to it.
Hey, Soph, I'll bring you into the conversation here because we're referring to your grandfather. Look, you're born a long time after he was at the peak of his powers as an international cricketer. But are there stories that your family has shared about your grandfather's time playing cricket for Australia?
Oh, to be honest, Ben, it's probably really refreshing speaking to someone that has spoken to him because we were quite modest. So a lot of these stories, I actually spoke about it, unfortunately, at Pop's funeral, but to me, he was always a grandpa. I didn't really have much knowledge of his cricketing eras. He didn't really speak to me about them, which is probably in hindsight a bit of a shame, but I'm starting to learn more and more things since he passed. But I think the main things that I'm keep on popping up, and he was quite conservative and he was quite strict. And so I can imagine in an era like the 60s when the Beatles are getting played that my pop is completely the reverse to that. And I'm interested in your thoughts and when you actually spoke to him, what he had to say about this era of cricket.
Well, first of all, Sophie, he was very proud of his achievements and rightly so. And he was such a good player. And I started really getting into watching cricket myself as a kid in the late 60s, but I saw him when he made his comeback in 1977-78. And I reckon he's still got the best cut shot I've ever seen, just right over the ball. It never, ever went in the air. You could tell he was a proper A-grade test cricketer. He's catching in the slips, a little bit of his leg spin. So there was that. I could see that clearly in, you know, the 77-78 when he came back. Also, he was such a, to me, such an approachable man. So I wrote a book about the Cricket World Cup tournaments in 1999. And I only ever spoke to him over the phone, but I just rang him and asked him if he'd do the forward, and he was quite happy to do that. Spoke to him a number of times. So he was obviously a really solid citizen and a good captain. And he was proudest of his first test century. He'd waited a long time. He'd been on the test scene for 7 years before he made 100. But when he got to 100, he made sure at Canada he got to 300 at Manchester in 1964. Now, sadly, that game is not remembered fondly by cricket historians because Australia batted first and got 656. Mm. And then it was obviously a good pitch and the bowling wasn't that good because then England got 611. So, and that was the game. There were big crowds based probably on what they'd seen in 61 in England, which was a really good series. But there was a lot of grizzling coming out of the ground. And then crowds just dwindled away through the late 60s. But no, your grandfather was a fine, fine player and a great man and can be proud of what he achieved, certainly, you know, in his cricket career as a player and a coach.
Yeah, he was not.
Sorry, go on.
He was a complete perfectionist, though. I played golf, and I remember Pop used to get me to throw ball after ball after ball down and have to explain exactly what I'd done wrong. So he was just as harsh on himself, and I'm sure that's why his technique was so incredible, and I think that's also why his slips catching was so great. But it's funny that you say that, you know, back in the 1960s, we were upset because a game only lasted two innings, but in the recent Ashes series, we had a game that only lasted 2 days. It's the complete reverse.
Well, yeah, there were two games like that, weren't there? So, yeah, it was breakneck speed, both of those games. I didn't find those particularly satisfying either.
Mm.
So, it's we like the balance, 3-4-5-day games, but a result, yeah.
What about the opening partnership between he and Bill Laurie? And Bill Laurie had an extraordinary career in the game and then in the commentary booth outside the game as well. But two incredibly dour characters who formed this incredible partnership where they're running between wickets, and you would have witnessed it, Mark, was something really ahead of its time.
Yes, they didn't even call, apparently. They just a nod and a wink, and away they went. And probably their most famous partnership was, again, in an Ashes test, was in Adelaide in 65 when Australia actually won 0 down in the series. And they put on 244, which was a record then. And they scored quickly enough, but they didn't hit many boundaries. They just sent the English side crazy with their running between wickets and all the singles they took and didn't even get close to a run out. So they were an amazing partnership. Bill Laurie, you know, thankfully Bill's still with us, which is great, but they were almost kindred spirits and, you know, they didn't play till they were 35 then. I think Bob was 32 when he retired the first time, handed the reins over to Bill, and Bill thought that he had to keep the side going and save the side. So he was even more dour as a batsman than Bob had been, which is a pity because all his contemporaries say he was such a talented batsman, and at times they'd see that come out. But he didn't have it. The attack, again, had slipped even further by the time Bill took over, and he was on a rescue mission time after time, but especially in the two Ashes series that he captained.
You probably talk about Dower. You probably know the story better than me, Mark. But there was a club grand final that Bill Laurie played in for Northcote, and I think it was a 4-day game, and he batted on every one of the 4 days. I think he batted right through all 4 days of the match. They were only looking for a draw to win the premiership, and Bill batted a lot of them. I have to ask you about Neil Harvey. You talked about the ill feeling between the two teams in the early 60s. To what extent did Neil exacerbate that. And he became that kind of character, almost like that dial-a-quote sort of character, didn't he?
A really interesting guy. And again, still with us. I think he's, what, he'll be 98 this year.
Yeah.
The last Invincible. And he sort of loomed large over the post-war period. A dashing batsman, but a little bit prickly, and overlooked as captain. Was he one of the reasons why, yeah, he probably wasn't happy with what happened with some of the Ashes cricket that he saw in the 50s. In 53, there were some strange tactics by the negative tactics by the Englishmen, particularly Trevor Bailey. Then in 56, there was the doctoring of the pitches. Then in 58-59, Australia won 4-0, but the English were unhappy with the bowling actions of some of the Australian bowlers, particularly Ian Metcalf. And if you ever get the chance to look at any footage of Ian Metcalf from the late 50s, you do go, whoa, how come he got away with that? So that was their gripe. So that built up, plus the pre-war tension with Bodyline and probably the English weren't happy with Bradman scoring 200 against them every time he went to bat. it's an intense rivalry, and it still exists, obviously, after the Bairstow affair in 23. But long may it last. It's wonderful. And, I sat at the recent Ashes series in Adelaide, Melbourne and Sydney, and you sit amongst the Poms, and they're great people. We're all just cricket fans. I've got some great English friends, but I don't want England to win anything.
And I noticed that Greg Chappell actually wrote the foreword. What was your thoughts on that? It was some very kind words that he had to say.
Greg Chappell's almost an elder statesman of Australian cricket, and I rate him, along with Ricky Ponting, and Steve Smith still gives it a bit of a nudge, as the two best batsmen that I've seen play for Australia in my lifetime. But he, with Ken Peacey, had this summer also released the Chappell Chronicles. And I did help Greg with just tweaking a couple of the factual aspects of the book. So of his book, the Chappell Chronicles. So he was happy to repay me by doing the foreword, which was a thrill. But he's, again, very easy to talk to. He was the last email I had from him. I sent him a copy of my book, and he was grateful. And he said, let's hope England can bounce back for the win in Adelaide. And I said, Greg, you're not sitting amongst the middle of the Barmy Army for 5 days. So if you do that, you'd realise that it's difficult to want England to win, as I said, any time. Really enjoyed doing my bit of work with Greg, and very grateful that he did the forward for me.
And he wrote it beautifully as well. Mark, you talked about the 60s. It was cricket that needed a bit of a spark in an era where everything else was sparking. How important was it that the Chappell brothers and Dennis Lilly and Rod Marsh emerged in those early 70s and I guess gave the international game, certainly from an Australian perspective, a new lease on life?
Oh, it was essential. So by 70-71, I think the best single day's crowd in the Melbourne test, the MCG test, which this year would have had 90,000 3 days in a row if it had gone 3 days, was 65,000, something like that. That was like one single day. So the whole thing was falling away. And, you know, in the end, they sacked Bill Laurie as captain just at that time for Ian Chappell. So straight away, Doug Walters said the dressing room atmosphere changed. Now, they actually, Ian Chappell's first test, they lost, but it was the best match of the series. And then, of course, he got Lilly in. Walters was already there. Walters was the first sign in 65 that things were going to change. You probably didn't realise at the time, but England had this bowler in the mid-60s called Fred Titmus, who just bowled these off-spinning darts that nobody could get away until Doug Walters came along. And he said, yeah, I liked off-spinners. So he came into the test team as a 19-year-old and started smacking Freddie Titmus around, which is the first sign. And then yeah, all these other guys came in the early 70s, Marsh, Lilly, the Chappell brothers. And that 72 Ashes series was fantastic. And if you read up about it, the journos and the people that covered it, they were taken by surprise at how entertained they were. They didn't expect it. They expected another set of draws, and it finished up 2-2. Chappell's young side came from behind twice to level it 2-2. So they didn't come home with the Ashes, but it set up the win in 74-75 when they also had Tomo. And, you know, that's one of the legendary series of Australian Ashes series of Australian cricket when Australia won 4-1 under the Chappell side. So, yeah, it was essential. And, you know, the crowds came back in England and Australia.
I was just thinking, we talk a bit about golf here as well, Mark, and I really feel like it was the lethargy of the PGA Tour that allowed LIV to emerge. Was that kind of similar, the way the game of cricket was administered in the 60s and early 70s, that allowed something like World Series cricket to really take a stronghold in the game? Did you see it like that?
Oh, I think so. As a kid, I was a bit nervous about the takeover and what it might do to my treasured Test cricket. But I'm a bit nervous at the moment about the future of Test cricket as well. Look, the players were paid a pittance. And back when Bradman played, of course, it wasn't a lot of money seemingly as well, but apparently it was enough in the 30s. They got paid enough for a tour of England in the 30s to put a deposit on a home. And it really hadn't changed much at all. So when Ian Chappell's side came along and they started dragging the people, not dragging, attracting the people back to the game in, you know, big crowds on Boxing Day and the SCG being full, sure enough, someone was going to come along, and if it wasn't Kerry Packer, it would have been somebody else.
Yeah.
Because they were grossly underpaid. And, you know, we know what happened with that. It was inevitable it was going to happen, and it dragged cricket further up, catching up with the times that we had in the late 70s. All those guys that were running the game saw it differently to how the world was at that time. So it wasn't just the players, it was the administrators as well. And certainly by the 70s, something had to be done. And it sorted itself out after a couple of years, of course. So we could all sit back and relax again.
Mark, congratulations on the book. I've had an opportunity to flip through a fair bit of it over the past 3 or 4 days. The Ashes, a front row seat to an iconic era of cricket in the 60s. Just tell us, where can you get it, mate? Where can we rustle up a copy?
Well, it's available at all good bookstores, so you can get it at Dimmicks. It's also online at Booktopia, QBD have got it, Amazon. Yeah, any of those, really. It's distributed by Wilkinson Publishing. You can buy it direct from the publisher, I believe. So any of the normal outlets. I hope people will enjoy it.
You've been able to move a couple of copies already, I hope?
It's a very hard thing to know exactly how many have been sold. Michael Wilkinson said you don't know until March, but I do know that in Geelong, it's a sellout. And I'd like to, at this time, thank all my family and friends who bought Christmas presents for either themselves or other people around the town.
Brilliant. Well, Mark, we really appreciate your time and commend you once again on what you've put together. And my birthday's coming up in a couple of weeks to my colleagues here at Hooked on Sport, so I'm sure that I'll have a copy of this coming for me very shortly. Mark, really appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us at Hooked on Sport.
Thanks so much for having me, Ben.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Sophie.
That was such a great interview. Loved every moment. I felt like we didn't even have to really ask any questions. He's so knowledgeable. He could just take on off with all his knowledge on the 60s cricket and beyond. He must have a wife who also loves cricket, because I can't imagine sitting there and listening to all of that. He's got so much knowledge. But no, Hooky, love speaking to you as always. Love speaking to you about cricket and picking your brain on all the news which has come up over the past fortnight. You've got exciting news for Hooked on Sport.
Yeah, so we're looking to broaden our horizons a little bit. So if most people would know that you pick up 2 golf episodes a fortnight from us and a cricket episode a fortnight, our plan is to segregate them out. So if you want to listen to our golf You'll stay here and it'll keep coming into your feed every week. If you want to listen to our cricket, and we'd love that you listen to our cricket, but we are going to be moving that to a separate free subscription, completely free. Won't have to pay a cent for it, but it'll just be a different subscribe that you'll click on. We'll send you all of the links for that. We'll make it as easy as possible. So if you just want our cricket, not our golf, you'll be able to pick us up on a separate channel. If you want our cricket and our golf, just make sure you subscribe to both. They'll both come in. Sophie and my opinion on cricket, golf will be there each and every week for you, but we might just try and segregate them out, because if you like one and not the other, we feel like we're probably not doing our best service to you, our wonderful listeners, by just sort of clogging up that feed a little bit. So hopefully that makes life a little bit easier for all of our listeners to do it down a separate channel. So keep an eye out for that in coming days, the separate cricket and golf podcast. We might even be coming up with a few little exciting, cute names for them as well. So if we'll keep working on that. We'll be having our brainstorming session with Wallace in coming days.
Yeah, can't wait. Hookie, as always, thank you so much and have a great week.
See you, Soph.
That stumps on this episode of the Hooked on Sport Cricket Show. Thanks for listening. Help us reach more cricket-minded people just like you by following us and leaving a review. We look forward to your company next time on the Hooked on Sport Cricket Show.